the rate of change is growing exponentially. It's faster times faster. And so the changes that we're talking about in our markets are dramatic. Now, where does that leave us as a regulator? Well, as much as those trading pits from the movie Trading Places are all closed, the rules we operate under were written for those markets.
Yeah, that's what this show is about.
The rules we deploy in our marketplace were written for those analog markets, and now we're in a digital world, and yet we still have an analog rule book. So what we need to do, and this is the biggest challenge, I think, facing the CFTC, but virtually every other regulator, and not just the financial regulators, is how do we take a 20th century analog rulebook and apply it in a new 21st century digital world?
Barefoot innovation starts right now.
Today's program is a very special one because it's a conversation about regulatory innovation with the very innovative acting chairman of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, or CFTC, Christopher Giancarlo. As our regular listeners know, I have spent many years in and around Washington, where there's a deeply entrenched belief, as there probably is in every capital city, that regulations and regulators simply can't change very much. Regulators in general, by both nature and design, are deliberate and cautious and risk averse. That's exactly how they're supposed to be. The slowness of regulatory change sometimes frustrates people, but I think most would agree that, broadly speaking, it's been better to err on the side of carefulness than boldness or inventiveness when you're taking regulatory actions that are going to ripple through big swaths of the economy, force change on whole industries, and often affect millions of customers. Today, though, I think the tilt toward slow and careful is being put under stress in finance because the world that our regulators are overseeing is changing too fast for the old system to keep working well. Our familiar regulatory models, stable, steady, solidly rooted, are being bombarded now by technology that's knocking them off their axes. These tech trends, which are much bigger than finance, are developing so fast and are so powerful that they're moving us toward a tipping over into a new world. And in that new world, we face a new paradigm, which is that if our regulators are going to be risk averse, they will not only have to address the dangers of changing, but also the rising dangers of not changing. Technology is growing exponentially, pulling finance along with us, and we're trying to regulate it with brains and institutions that are hardwired for linear pace change. We increasingly are going to face the danger of getting things wrong, potentially very wrong, because of falling behind. Fortunately, a growing group of regulatory leaders in the United States and in other countries have seen this shift and are taking on its challenge. One of the most interesting is Christopher Giancarlo. Last summer, he and I spoke at the same conference in New York and happened to sit together at lunch, where he started talking about technology and innovation in ways that I frankly had never heard before from a financial regulator. At the time, he was a commissioner at the CFTC. He'd been named to that post by President Obama and had been confirmed unanimously by the Senate. And then this year, President Trump has appointed him acting chairman and now has nominated him to be the chairman going forward. Senate action is expected soon on that. It could be that by the time this show is posted, he'll actually be confirmed as the commission's chairman. So this spring, shortly after coming into this role, he launched an initiative that is called LAB-CFTC, L-A-B-CFTC. Its goal is to focus and build the Commission's very extensive work in fintech and regtech innovation. As he explains in our conversation, the lab is pursuing a wide range of activities, from guiding innovators about how to work with regulatory requirements, to participating in research, and to building stronger collaboration among financial agencies, something I think we desperately need. I knew it would be fascinating to have Chairman Giancarlo as a guest on Barefoot Innovation, but I wasn't prepared for the full vision that he laid out in our discussion. I think this is the single most thought-provoking and eloquent case I have ever heard from a senior official about why and how regulators of all kinds absolutely have to change. Remember, the CFTC plays an enormous role today in overseeing financial markets. Its mandate was expanded after the financial crisis far beyond its traditional focus on commodities, and it now oversees the derivative markets and works to reduce risk to the economy associated with the futures and swap markets, areas where, as he explains, technology is basically changing everything. I know you'll enjoy hearing the chairman's far-ranging insights, from the historical reasons why payments are cleared in 3 days to his eye-opening experience visiting a modern-day high-tech family farm. So here's my conversation with acting CFTC chairman Christopher Giancarlo. I'm absolutely delighted today to say that my guest is Christopher Giancarlo, the acting chairman of the CFTC. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
You're acting chairman and appointed by the president to become the chairman, so maybe by the time this posts, that will already have happened. We're really thrilled to have you as our guest today.
Thank you. I have actually a somewhat unique approach in that I was originally appointed by President Obama and confirmed by a Democrat Senate unanimously. I've now been nominated by President Trump to serve as chairman, and I'll soon be going in front of a Republican Senate seeking confirmation for my new role. So I can't get any more bipartisan than that.
I think it's a very good sign. It's wonderful to see that there's broad bipartisan support for leaders in Washington today. When I first met you, it was about a year ago. We were at a conference in New York. We happened to sit next to each other, and you were a commissioner then. And I remember being fascinated by our conversation because, to be candid, you were one of the few people at that level in the regulatory agencies who was so focused on technology and innovation. And ever since then, I've been wanting to sit down with you and have a chance to talk with you about this. So I think the place I'd like to start is just to ask you to talk a little bit about yourself, your own background,
sure,
the journey that brought you here.
Thank you. So I spent 16 years practicing law in New York and London, business law, really advising, in many cases, probably the predominant part of my practice was advising technology companies in mostly offshore, based in Europe and Asia, on doing business in the United States and accessing U.S. Both capital and product markets, advised a number of early stage companies in the biotech space and in the early internet days, electronic technologies in doing business. And that's actually what got me into business, because one of my clients was a company that made an algorithmic-based pricing tool for currency options, a company called Fenix. And I represented Fenix in 1999 in a sale to what was then a Wall Street startup that was building trading systems in New York and around the world for trading instruments called credit default swaps.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
I didn't know much about credit default swaps that time, but I did know how to take companies through financing through private equity and eventually into the public markets. And the founder of GFI asked me if I'd come on and help the firm do just that. And I joined as head of corporate development and raised 3 rounds of private equity in the early 2000s. And then in 2005, we successfully IPO'd the company on the NASDAQ. And then we changed its listing to the New York Stock Exchange in 2006. And along the way, we built electronic trading platforms for credit default swaps around the world in 18 different jurisdictions. And in 2008, when the financial crisis came, we were the largest venue for trading swaps, credit default swaps, and other swaps in the world. And so when Congress took up the Dodd-Frank Act in 2009, I was asked to testify on how the swaps world worked. As angry as people may have been about the market, they didn't blame us as the trading platform. When the New York Stock Exchange drops 500 points, you might blame a lot of people, but you don't blame the New York Stock Exchange. Well, similarly, we were the ones that actually knew how the market works. So, as I say, I testified numerous times in front of Congress, and in early 2013, when a seat on the Commodity Futures Trading Commission became vacant. And by that point, Dodd-Frank had passed, and the CFTC, this agency, had been given responsibility for 90% of the over-the-counter swaps market. When that seat became vacant, President Obama asked me if I would take that position. And as I say, I was confirmed by the U.S. Senate in 2014 and took a seat here as a commissioner. And so I've, after almost 30 years in business, in 2014, I joined the commission. And I've worked here. And then when President Trump was elected, he asked me to come on as chairman. And I've been serving as acting chairman since Inauguration Day. And as I said, I've been nominated. I'm expecting a hearing quite soon in front of the Senate Agricultural Committee, which oversees the CFTC, which is something I'm sure we'll talk about. Our oversight by the Ag Committee gives us a unique perspective on some of these markets.
That's actually a perfect segue, because let's take a moment and talk about what the CFTC does, and we'll put more information on that in the show notes. But
So,
you say, the very fact that it's the Agriculture Committee for some people.
So the CFTC's history goes back to the mid-1970s. Virtually nobody will know this, but there was a bit of a scandal of some market manipulation in the Maine potato market. So before the Idaho potato became the standard potato in the United States, it was the Maine potato. That was traded on the New York NYMEX, and there was a bit of a scandal. And Congress took a group out of the Agriculture Department that was focused on these markets and created a separate agency, the CFTC. And the roots of the agency are in the agricultural commodity futures market. So if you think about the famous movie Trading Places with Eddie Murphy,
Yes. It
features a scene of the New York, of the NYMEX, with men and women on the trading floor hooting and hollering and using hand signals to signal buy and sell orders. And so when people think of this agency, they think of things like pork bellies and orange juice and that sort of thing. That's still a part of our mission, but our mission is become much broader than that. In the 1980s, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange created financial futures on currency and on interest rates and other financial products. And those products are now an enormous part of the market. And then, as you know, in the 1980s, 90s, and 2000s, the over-the-counter swaps market grew into the world's largest marketplace. When we talk about financial over-the-counter derivatives, we're talking about marketplace measured in the hundreds of trillions of dollars. So just to give you an order of magnitude, to compare what the CFTC does to, say, the SEC, the SEC oversees a market that is probably measured in somewhere in $100 trillion with, if you think about, 30, 40 trillion in equities and maybe another 60 trillion in bonds. The CFTC's market is probably 8 or 9 times the size of that. Now, you don't hear about the CFTC so much because, for the most part, we regulate professional markets that are not traded by retail market participants, whereas the SEC's market affects everybody's retirement savings and their investment in public companies. But the universe of a world that we oversee is a much, much bigger world. To use that comparison in another regard, I think will really help understand what we do. The Securities Exchange Commission, the SEC, oversees the investment transfer market. So if you want to invest in an enterprise, company like Intel, for example, you can buy its shares and have an opportunity to participate in the upside of that company. If you want a safer investment, you might invest in the debt of a company, maybe Ford Motor Company's bonds. You're still investing in that enterprise, and if you decide to change from bonds to equities, you will transfer that investment to somebody who wishes to get into it in return for either cash or another investment. But effectively, the SEC is overseeing the investment transfer market. That's not what we do at the CFTC. We oversee the risk transfer market. if you're a farmer and you know that you're going to spend money on fertilizer and seed and irrigation of a field, you know what your costs are. But what your risk is what the price you'll get at the end of that growing season for your crop. That's your risk. You can transfer that risk for surety in our futures market. But whether it's farmers or whether it is banks that can want to provide certainty to their borrowers in the form of fixed interest rates, they will use the interest rate swaps market to convert the reality of fluctuating global interest rates in return for certainty of fixed rates. So the reason why Americans enjoy a 30-year fixed rate mortgage as our standard purchasing tool for a new home is because our financial institutions are a major player in the global interest rate swap market, where they can trade uncertainty for certainty. We in the West, whether it's the United States or Europe and many parts of the West, we expect day in, day out, every time we visit the grocery store to find fresh fruit and vegetables on the shelves, and we expect to see them at relatively stable prices. We never ask when we go to the supermarket, well, I wonder if it was a good growing season on the farm. I wonder whether there was enough sunlight to provide good vegetables. I wonder whether when I visit the supermarket, there will be adequate produce there. And the reason we never have to ask that question is because of the derivative markets. If you've ever visited the developing world, when they have a good growing season, there's plentiful food. But when they have a bad growing season, there's no food on the shelves. And worse, there'll be no food on the shelves next year, because their farmers will have gone bankrupt by the lack of being able to achieve their price point. We don't have that problem because of our derivative markets. Our derivative markets are what provide the relative lifestyle stability, whether it's in a fixed rate for a car loan, home mortgage, relatively stable prices for the energy we use to power our homes, power our electronic devices, heat, gasoline. The derivatives surround everything we do, even though most Americans are not participants in those markets. The prices that we pay for commodities are based upon those markets. So they're vitally important, and they're very, very large.
That is by far the best explanation I've ever heard. I'm glad I asked. So enormous complexity, and also all of this is being impacted by rapidly changing technology. As you know, our show is about mostly about how innovation and technology are changing financial markets, and both on the industry side and also how to do better on the regulatory side as well. So talk about how you see both the upside opportunity and the downside risk emerging.
Sure. So, you know, I mentioned that Eddie Murphy movie, Trading Places, and the famous scene of the trading pits. Well, that movie is only 30 years old, and yet what you saw in that movie is gone. Those trading pits are closed. Many of those trading floors today are television studios. They're not trading pits anymore. All of what you saw in the movie is now taking place virtually. Increasingly in our markets, as much in our ag commodity markets, as much as 50% in the financial futures market, as much as 80% of the execution is now being driven by algorithmic trading. But it's even moving beyond that. It's not just so much algorithms. We now have algorithms using machine learning to learn from other algorithms.
Yeah.
The algorithms in the market are actually evolving based upon trading conditions in the market. And then when you add on to that the emergence of smart contracts, which are also themselves going to adapt over time, and then the ability to analyze massive quantities of data through big data technology, cloud computing, which is going to make even smaller market participants able to compete against larger ones in terms of being able to store and analyze data. And that's even before we get to some new innovations like the blockchain, which I think are going to revolutionize many of these markets and are going to be a very disruptive force for a lot of traditional market roles. You know, one of the standards in our markets that have been around for a long, long time are settlement periods. Whether it's 3 days, 2 days, the notion that a trade can be agreed upon, and yet there's a set period of time for settlement. Well, the old 3 day settlement period is based upon the time it took for the mail to be delivered.
Huh.
3 days equated to the standard time of delivery of mail service.
Sure.
Well, what does that mean in a market where communications are instantaneous? That's where we're moving. But if you think about how much of the financial market infrastructure is built upon those settlement times, firms that exist to do the record keeping and the distribution and the float, just the interest rate float, that provides a lot of income for firms in this space, that's going to be completely disrupted when we go to same-day settlement. Same-day, the next thing is going to be same-minute.
Yeah.
Most of our clearinghouses operate on the basis of end-of-day calculation of margin. Well, why should we stop at end-of-day? It used to be you needed to stop because you needed to shut down the clearinghouse in order to stop everything and take stock of where you stand. But with new technologies, those calculations can be done every second. Every trade could do a separate calculation of margin. And that changes a lot of things as well. So we are moving, and as your listeners well know, the rate of change is growing exponentially. It's faster times faster. And so the changes that we're talking about in our markets are dramatic. Now, where does that leave us as a regulator? Well, as much as those trading pits from the movie Trading Places are all closed, the rules we operate under were written for those markets.
Yeah, that's what this show is about.
The rules we deploy in our marketplace were written for those analog markets, and now we're in a digital world, and yet we still have an analog rule book. So what we need to do, and this is the biggest challenge, I think, facing the CFTC, but virtually every other regulator, and not just the financial regulators, is how do we take a 20th century analog rule book and apply it in a new 21st century digital world? And that is the biggest challenge facing this agency and virtually every other one of them. How do we take rules that were written for a different time and place and update them? Now, one way would be to start at the front of the book and work to the end. You know what? Maybe in 20 years, we might get halfway through our rule book.
But then what you did at the beginning would be out of date by then.
Exactly right. So maybe what we need to do is actually take a page out of what Innovator's doing and think about it almost from a crowdsourcing approach. Let's let the marketplace point us to which of our rules are most out of date and prioritize the updating of them based upon demand. And that's what we're trying to do with Lab CFTC, which is a new project, the CFTC. I want to give some credit to a terrific executive of the agency, Jeff Bandman,
who wrote
the blueprint for Lab CFTC. We recently announced it, and it is going to allow us to do two very important things. The first one is to try to take some of the regulatory uncertainty out of financial technology innovation. I was at a terrific conference in New York City a couple of weeks ago, put on by the New York Financial Technology Laboratory. And I was talking to an early stage venture funder there who told me that he had been looking at a company for 18 months that he was very interested in funding. And his due diligence pointed to a potential regulatory issue. And he asked the company to reach out. I'm happy to say it wasn't the CFTC, but it was another financial regulator. He asked the company to get confirmation from that agency if they were regulated, what would be the requirements, or if they were not regulated, to let them know. And he said after 18 months of waiting, they still didn't have an answer. And therefore, he didn't fund the company. He just felt that he needed to move on to the next thing. So that is a potentially promising innovation that's not getting funded because of regulatory uncertainty. So the first part of our Lab CFTC is to work with financial technology innovators to be responsive, to at least determine where they fit within the regulatory scale, within the regulatory framework. If they are subject to our regulations, to let them know, and then to work with them to help them comply with our rules. If they're not subject to our regulations, to let them know that as well. That is what we call guide point. And guide point is, as the name sounds, an ability to guide and point them in the right direction. The other side of this, and this is what goes to the heart of how do we update our rule book, is what we call CFTC 2.0. And that is where we partner with fintech innovations, whether it be a blockchain proof of concept opportunity or another type of financial innovation, where we can, by that, understand which of our rule sets are actually inhibiting the development of some of these new technologies, and therefore prioritize our efforts in updating our rule book based upon where we really see it bumping up against some new technological innovation.
And is this going to include more use of technology in the market monitoring and regulatory process itself, what we could call RegTech solutions?
Absolutely. So I'm excited about technology for a whole range of reasons. At heart, technology leads to economic growth, and goodness knows we need more economic growth, not just in the United States, but throughout globally. But we have a mission to do. One of the things that was very clear in the 2008 financial crisis, at the heart of the crisis, was a lack of clarity into the counterparty credit exposure of one large financial institution to another. In the midst of the crisis, there was real concern as to whether the failure of one financial institution would lead to the failure of another because of the connectedness of them through their swaps exposure book. And the lack of understanding of that, the lack of transparency, led to a full-blown traditional market panic, and that's a lot of what was at heart of the crisis. Yeah. Transparency is an antidote to that type of market panic. And so Dodd-Frank rightly in Title VII require that swaps transactions be reported to what they dubbed swap data repositories. And here we are 9 years after the financial crisis, 7 years after Dodd-Frank, and we still don't have that regulatory transparency despite the best efforts, the hardest work by the regulated community and the regulators. And part of the problem is technological. We are still trying to build these swap data repositories very much the old-fashioned way, and that is collecting data from trades, scrubbing that data, recreating that data so it looks like a trading blotter, having to have sharing because Congress decided that the CFTC would have 90% of the market, but the SEC would have 10%, and then that's the U.S. market. You've got European regulators and Asian regulators. So to get a truly global picture of systemic risk, you need a level of regulatory cooperation on data sharing that is relatively, that is unprecedented. All of that complexity could be dramatically transcended with the blockchain. Instead of needing to manually gather and reassemble those trading positions, if regulators had a node on a blockchain where all of these financial institutions were actually sharing their ledgers with one another and self-correcting their ledger through a blockchain mechanism, then we regulators could see not ex post facto, but in real time, the trading book of the regulated entities.
Yeah, complete data.
With complete data, self-correcting and self-certifying. So the blockchain is potentially a technical solution to a crisis that happened almost a decade ago, and maybe we're 5 to 10 years away from a blockchain solution. Perhaps within 20 years, we actually will have the transparency that had we had it back in 2008 may have gone a long way to maybe perhaps avoiding some of the panic.
You mentioned Jeff Bandman. I hosted an event at Harvard University recently on RegTech, and Jeff was able to participate in that. And part of what we were positing to a group of deep regulatory experts and deep technology experts is the vision of taking these regulatory systems that are basically linear and, as you say, analog systems and trying to transform them into actual systems. So from process to system in which the data is being put through a computational process and just take all of these old steps out of the process, which, as you said, is the technology exists to do this. It's really, do you agree with this? It's sort of a matter of regulatory focus.
It's a combination. The technology is almost there, but it's not quite there yet. And as you know, perfecting core technology, then getting the applications in place is another step. But exactly what you say, though, is actually a part of a bigger picture, and that is that, and I'm saying this as someone who supports Title VII of Dodd-Frank, which are the swaps provisions, but Dodd-Frank entirety and the global efforts at reg reform in the wake of the crisis have added, for their benefits, the flip side is that they've added enormous operational and capital complexity to our financial markets. That can't be denied by people that are both supporters or detractors from Dodd-Frank, that the complexity that's been added to financial service, whether they are banking services, insurance services, prime brokerage, futures commission, merchant services, all of these financial services have become infinitely more complex, and the use of capital itself has been harder and more complex. The solution will be found in technology. It's technology that is going to transcend that complexity and make the reforms actually affordable. Right now, we've got reforms, many of which were needed. Perhaps some of the implementation is not optimal, but certainly the broad concept of some of the reforms are needed: greater bank capital, a margin on uncleared swaps, swaps through clearinghouses, reporting swaps to repositories, licensing of swap intermediaries. Those were all sensible reforms. The application of them, though, has added complexity, has added cost. It's technology that's going to allow us to address the complexity, address the cost. And I'm hopeful that what will be left will be sensible reforms that are able to be managed in an efficient way and once again get to a sound financial sector that is absolutely essential to a revival of economic prosperity.
Yeah. I'm a former regulator myself, and I always say I think the regulators have the hardest job in all of this. They really sort of have to walk the knife edge, allowing good innovation to occur but still blocking these risks. And it's not easy. So I know we're running late on time. What would you offer as advice to the ecosystem of people who are working on these challenges, whether it's in the industry? Oh, and before we finish, too, I hope you'll talk about how technology is changing farming, because I've heard you speak on that before as well.
Sure. I like this story because it really tells you how much the world has changed. I was visiting Texas last spring. I was actually meeting with a farmer who farmed multiple crops. I was actually meeting with him to discuss his cotton crop. We oversee a cotton futures contract at the CFTC, and I wanted to better understand that. But as we drove along in, I think it was March, it might have been early April, we passed a field that had just been cut. And I asked him what the field was, and he said winter wheat. And then he threw out, he said, we cut it last night. And as we drove along a little further, I just kind of weighed in my mind, and I said, being the complete non-farming type that I am from northern New Jersey, I said, how did you cut it at night? And he said, oh, you want to see something really cool? And he pulled his pickup to the side of the road, and he took out his iPhone. He gave it a couple of swipes, and then he handed it to me, and I stared at it. What I saw was a video, and it was almost pitch black. But in the center of it, what clearly were four headlights. And he adjusted the brightness, and I could basically make out that one of them was a tractor, and the other one was a combine. And the combine was cutting the field, and the tractor was running alongside it, and the combine, after it had cut the wheat, was shooting it through a projector into a cart that was being pulled by the tractor. And I asked him to tell me what I was looking at, and he said, well, the combine was inhabited by a sun, but it wasn't being driven by a sun because it was being driven by GPS satellite. He was in the tractor, but he wasn't driving the tractor. He was working some of the controls that were weighing the wheat as it was coming in his tractor. He didn't need to drive the tractor because it was being carried along by vehicle telemetry driven by the combine. And the whole video was being shot by his drone, which was in the sky following his iPhone. And as I thanked them for this, and we finished our tour, and later I got on the flight and flew back to Washington. I started to reflect on it. I was thinking to myself, how interesting that farming, which is an activity that since the dawn of humankind on the earth has been a daylight activity, can now be done in the middle of the night by a father and son using digital technology. And you think about how transformational that is, that, again, an activity that was limited to daylight hours can now be done around the clock with so little manpower. It's quite remarkable. And then it made me think, well, if, and this, by the way, was an 8,000-acre farm, which by Texas standards is slightly below middle size. Small family operation, yet they can afford this technology. So if you think that a family-owned farm can afford this level of digital technology, what about the billions of dollars that are deployed in our financial markets by our modern market participants? If you think about the technology they can deploy. So when we, you know, coming back to Washington as a regulator of our financial markets, the awesome power of technology and the awesome deployment of that in our markets is really somewhat stunning and daunting when you think about our job to oversee these markets and how technology is changing everything from farming all the way up to our markets. And we have to be up to that curve. We have to be not only up to the curve, we have to be trying to get ahead of that curve.
So it's so exciting to listen to you. You have this vision. You've thought it through. It's clear to you, at least directionally, what we need to do, what a lot of the big opportunities are. How are we going to get there? What are the important things that need to happen to the community of people who are interested in this to make us able to optimize this?
Okay. So I'd have one piece of advice to regulators and then one piece of advice to innovators. My advice to regulators is do not try to be market engineers, platform engineers, marketplace designers. We will get that wrong every time. It's not what we should be doing. The marketplace needs to design its market structure. The innovators need to deploy their technology. Our job as regulators is to understand where it's going, but not try to change its necessary direction. We need to come to these markets with core principles about access, about openness, about fairness, about anti-manipulation, about how do we get to durable markets. But the last thing we want is static markets, because markets are organic things. They are always evolving. And our job as regulators is not to get in the way of that evolution, but to understand it and always make sure that those principles are reflected in the markets.
Do you think that agencies need to have an innovation lab of the kind that you're launched in order to be able to know how to do that?
Well, I don't know how they can stay ahead of the curve if they don't. Now, whether it's the way we've done it there's a lot of different flavors of this. The British are way out in front with their Project Innovate and with their Innovation Sandbox. They're doing this in Singapore and Hong Kong and Australia and Japan. And I tip my hat to those regulators. Each of them are coming at it in a different way that's appropriate for their markets and their style of regulation. And I think other U.S. regulators should approach it in their own way. But at the end of the day, if we're not learning, we're falling behind. If we're not engaged with innovators, then they're passing us by. So we need to stay engaged. And that comes my second piece of advice to financial technology and regulatory technology innovators: engage with us. I know there's a mantra, certainly on the West Coast, don't ask permission, ask for forgiveness. Mm-hmm. But sometimes underneath that is, as far as you can, stay out of the regulator's way and don't engage with them. And I can think there's probably plenty of anecdotal reasons for that to be the watchword. But I think the better way is to engage with us. Make us learn. Make us understand. Help us to understand. And if you are bringing benefits to the market, then there's no reason why you shouldn't be evangelists for those innovations when you deal with regulators. Make us understand the benefits you're bringing to the market and help us accommodate you in this new evolving regulatory landscape for this new digital 21st century world.
I cannot thank you enough for spending time with me, Christopher Giancarlo. Tell us how to find information on the CFTC.
So we have a great website, cftc.gov. Take a look at that, and I'm an active Twitterer, so you can follow me at Giancarlo CFTC and engage with us, engage with our new lab CFTC, which is found on our website as well. And we look forward to working with many of your listeners in the future.
This has been fascinating and inspiring and thought-provoking, so I can't thank you enough for being our guest today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Christopher Giancarlo, Acting Chairman of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Again, go to their site and or to jsbarefoot.com for further information. Remember also to review Barefoot Innovation on iTunes, and please sign up to get emails that will bring you the newest podcast, newsletter, and blog posts at jsbarefoot.com. Also, please join my Facebook fan page and follow me on Twitter at Joanne Barefoot. And meanwhile, watch for upcoming shows. These are going to include a special series that I recorded from the floor of the ABA's annual Regulatory Compliance Conference, including one with Gene Ludwig and Alistair Rennie of IBM's Watson Financial, who talk about how artificial intelligence and machine learning will be transforming compliance. We also have a very thought-provoking discussion coming up with John Ryan of the Conference of State Bank Supervisors. We're going to hear from Sanjay Jain, who helped build India's revolutionary so-called tech stack project that has captured customer identity information on more than a billion people in India. And last but not least, we're going to have the great Brett King. See you soon.